This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you happen to walk by the Starbucks on Comm Ave in Brookline today, you might hear something like this.
Hey, hey, ho, ho, this manager has got to go. Hey, hey, ho, ho, this manager has got to go.
Get up,
get down. Boston is a union town. Get up, get down. Boston is a union town.
Employees of the 874 Commonwealth Avenue location are on strike as of Monday, so let's talk about it. Here with us now, Spencer Costigan, a shift manager at the 874 Commonwealth Avenue Starbucks location. Spencer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And I do want to note, we reached out to Starbucks to invite the location's manager or the corporate office to join us. They declined. They sent us a statement. We'll give you some of that in a bit. But for now, Spencer, you announce in a letter, 4 a.m. Monday morning or so, you're going to strike. It's day four now. It's a heat wave. Standing in front of your store, is it what you expected? How's it going?
Honestly, it's going better than I expected. We've had such an incredible outpouring of support from not only other Starbuckses, be they unionized or not, but local unions and just passersby, people who want to stop and just offer support. We've really been shocked and pleasantly surprised by just how well things have been received.
So I want to back up. You and your coworkers, you vote to unionize in June. Tell us why. How did that part come about?
Well, I mean, Starbucks is not exactly a high-paying job. Boston is a pretty expensive city. And we all decided, hey, we'd like to unionize so we could try to improve these conditions. Maybe we could get some more pay. Maybe we could get some better hour guarantees. Maybe we could get some better health care coverage and make it easier for partners who are part-time to get health care coverage.
So, Spencer, you don't have to tell me how much you make an hour, but roughly the members of your store, roughly how much do they make an hour?
So most of them are making about $15 an hour, which is just not tenable for Massachusetts and Boston especially.
So what happened after you voted to unionize?
Well, we voted to unionize officially. The vote was counted on June 3rd. Less than a week after that, our previous manager left, and we were introduced with this new manager who has immediately started to do some classic union busting tactics, cutting our hours and like flooding the store with new hires, understaffing shifts, and generally being a nuisance.
So we are talking with Spencer Costigan, who's a Starbucks shift manager at 874 Commonwealth Avenue, where they have been on strike since Monday. Starbucks sent us a statement. Spencer, I'm going to read it here. We're aware of a strike at the 874 Commonwealth Avenue store location today. Starbucks values each of our partners, and we respect their legal rights to engage in organizing activity or protest. Allegations of retaliation for organizing are patently false. We are grateful for each partner who did come into work today, and we are doing our best to listen to the concerns of all of our partners, end quote. That was as of yesterday afternoon. What's your response?
Well, I mean, nobody went to work at my store, so I'm not sure if they're talking about any of us.
So is the store closed right now?
The store is closed. It has been since Sunday, and I mean, it's going to continue to stay closed until they choose to negotiate with us in good faith.
Have you heard directly from management or corporate over these last few days?
I have not personally, but I know that the district manager has reached out to a couple people in my store, including another shift manager, at least one other shift manager, and a couple of baristas.
So what do you think is the next step in the process?
Well, the next step for us is to wait until they're willing to talk to us as a collective rather than trying to get individuals to, contradict each other or what have you. We're definitely like one unit, and we demand to be treated as such. And we're going to stay outside and protest until that's how they choose to engage with us.
How long are you prepared to do that?
As long as it takes. It's a kind of a scary prospect, doing an indefinite strike. But I mean, that's the only way that these people will listen to us is if we choose to shut down their business for an indefinite amount of time.
How are you making ends meet?
Well, we have a lot of really generous people donating to, like, our strike fund. And then, of course, through the union, we have a portion of our pay being covered. Me, personally, I just have a little bit in my savings that I don't mind dipping into. But a lot of us are also students, not me personally, but there are a lot of, like, students who mostly use the job for, like, you know, to get some spending money. So they're less financially dependent than some of our other employees, so they can stand to wait it out a little longer.
Spencer, it's hard for me to imagine that doing this and putting yourself in this position isn't personal for you. So what do you personally want out of this?
Well, I personally see this not as just a strike for our store, but as a like the first step in hopefully getting better treatment for other Starbucks in the area and also other workers in the area. This is ultimately like a movement of labor. And, you know, the better that one business in an area is forced to treat their employees, the better that all the businesses in the area have to, you know, compete to keep up with that. So hopefully we'll see if we can start something bigger than ourselves.
Spencer Costigan is a shift manager at the 874 Commonwealth Avenue Starbucks. They've been on strike since Monday. Spencer, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
So joining us now, John Logan, a business professor and department chair at San Francisco State University and an expert on anti-union activities and legislation. John, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be on. Thank you.
So John, I know you were listening to the conversation with Spencer. Reactions to what you just heard?
Yeah, you know, really what Spencer is describing is part of a nationwide pattern. I mean, just to back up really quickly, the Starbucks organizing campaign started in Buffalo, New York last December. They won two elections in Buffalo in December. They've now won almost 200 nationwide, including a significant number in Massachusetts and some spread to Vermont, to Maine, to Connecticut. They've won 52 of these elections unanimously. A lot of the others they've won overwhelmingly. And they've won in parts of the country where unions don't normally win. And it's also about how they've done it. It's really spread through the sort of grassroots dynamism of worker organizers like Spencer all over the country. I mean, this is the dynamic through which the campaign has spread. But and it's remarkably successful. I mean, almost unique in recent U.S. labor history. But the success of the campaign, I think, has in some ways obscured a really ferocious anti-union campaign and unlawful anti-union campaign. And, you know, you don't need to take my word for it. National Labor Relations Board at the moment is processing over 200 unfair labor practice charges against Starbucks all over the country.
So let me stop you there for a minute, John, to ask for some examples. You say ferocious. So
yes.
Give me an example of what's ferocious.
Sure, of course. So there's actually a hearing before an administrative law judge in Buffalo, New York, as we speak, which is covering the anti-union campaign just in Buffalo from last fall. The NLRB found that Starbucks had committed over 200 individual violations of federal labor law just in Buffalo, just at the half dozen or so stores. It had fired 7 workers. It had closed stores. It had spied on workers. It had threatened workers. It had offered workers benefit if they opposed unionization. And you know, the list goes on. So, you know, I could, you know, take up a lot of time just telling you all of the things that the NLRB complaint from the regional director, which came out in May, said that Starbucks was guilty of.
So let me note, and I feel like I need to, that's an interested party, the NLRB.
Yeah.
Does your research show that this is typical behavior?
Well, the NLRB is an independent government agency. You know, these are very neutral fact-finding investigations. You know, they have to find merit in the complaint. They try to get the parties to settle. If not, you know, it goes before an administrative law judge and then to the full NLRB. It's very unusual to have this many allegations of unfair labor practice charges in such a short period of time and all over the country. And so, you know, there are allegations of over 40 workers who say that they have been fired as a result of their involvement in the anti-union campaign. And the purpose is to send a message. You know, they don't have to fire every single worker. They just have to, you know, fire and retaliate and to threaten to take away benefits enough that it will create this chilling atmosphere at Starbucks stores throughout the country.
So, John, I'm going to remind listeners that we invited Starbucks to send the manager of 874 Commonwealth Avenue in Brookline, where they're striking, or someone from corporate office. They sent a statement instead. A little bit of that statement: Starbucks values each of our partners, and we respect their legal rights to engage in organizing activity or protest. Allegations of retaliation for organizing are patently false. And yet you are laying out a track record from an independent governing body saying that is not true. So what's the strategy, the game here from Starbucks? And compared to other organizations facing unionization, where do they sort of fit on the anti-union Richter scale, if you will?
Well, the problem is that, you know, obviously companies like Starbucks, and you could say Amazon clearly too, have very deep pockets with which to fight these union campaigns. And, you know, by all accounts, they're prepared to do whatever is necessary in order to try to defeat the workers' efforts to choose a union. And the problem with the board is two very long-standing problems. One is the problem of delay. If workers are fired for union activity, if they're retaliated against, if their stores are threatened with closure, or if they're closed, as has happened in Ithaca, New York, in Buffalo and other places, it takes months and months and months for the board's processes to work themselves out. And eventually the workers might get reinstated, they often do, with back pay if they weren't working in the meantime. Eventually, Starbucks might be ordered to reopen the stores. But in the meantime, the damage has been done. The second thing is that, unfortunately, the remedies for violations of the law are completely inadequate. And so, you know, for anti-union companies such as Starbucks that are determined not to give their workers a fair choice on unionization, breaking the law is just the cost of doing business.
We're talking with John Logan, who's a professor at San Francisco State University, about Starbucks and its approach to unionizing across the country. After Spencer Costigan joined us, they are a Starbucks shift manager at 874 Commonwealth Avenue here in Brookline area that is striking now. John, Starbucks for a long time was celebrated as a company that was great to its employees.
Yeah.
So square that circle, and I, you know, you're laying out, you know, some clear cases here. But what happens that a company goes from that to this?
Well, you know, Starbucks, as you said, has a very progressive reputation. You know, is very good on issues like LGBTQ rights. Is very good on, you know, issues of environmental justice. Compared with many companies, it attracts progressive employees. It attracts, you know, by and large, a progressive clientele. But, you know, for some time, but particularly during the pandemic, I think, you know, workers saw their jobs get, you know, harder, more stressful, more dangerous, and in many ways sort of felt abandoned by Starbucks management. You know, many of these problems to do with understaffing had been building for some time. But the pandemic was really, I think, the breaking point for a lot of workers and you who began to feel that the only way that we can get just treatment on the job is by having an independent voice, by having a seat at the bargaining table. And this is what they want. I mean, Howard Schultz has said in an interview that he will never engage with the union because it would undermine the customer experience.
Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks.
Howard Schultz, yes, sorry, the interim CEO, former CEO. I think there's zero evidence that it would undermine the customer experience. You know, Disney, theme parks are unionized, people have a great time with many other employers. However, even if that were the case, unfortunately for Howard Schultz, as a question of law, the issue is not whether a union would undermine the customer experience. The issue is whether or not his employees want to choose a union. And the law demands that they get a fair choice. And at the moment, Starbucks is trying to deny that fair choice at every store throughout the country. It's essentially said that, you know, it's going to improve benefits, it's going to improve wages, but only if your store is not engaged in organizing activity. Now, I would say disingenuously, the company has said its hands are tied by the law. It can't change the conditions for stores that have unionized or are organizing. But actually, these stores have already written to Starbucks, made very clear, we will file no objections. We want you to extend these benefits to everyone. And eventually, everyone will get them. But again, you know, Starbucks at the store level and at the corporate level is telling workers, if you engage in organizing activity, you will lose benefits that you really care about, whether it be college benefits, the benefits transfer store, even abortion and trans-specific healthcare benefits.
And that's
it's
illegal.
Really trying to create a climate of fear around the issue of union organizing. And yes, that is unlawful.
All right. John Logan is professor at San Francisco State University Department Chair and an expert on anti-union activities and legislation. Professor Logan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We have some special neighbors along New England shores, and they're moving in fast.
If we weren't trapping them right now, they'd be walking the streets. They'd be coming down the driveway.
Green crabs. This invasive species growing in numbers here and across the country, and one solution is to drink them. I know, but wait. So here to talk more about this, Will Robinson, who is a distiller at Tamworth Distilling and Mercantile in New Hampshire. They've just released a batch of green crab-flavored whiskey, and Alicia Lumia. She is a founding board member of the newly formed organization greencrab.org. She handles marketing for Wolf's Fish, a wholesale fish company in Boston. Will, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Alicia, great to have you here in studio, too.
Thank you.
So, Alicia, I'm going to start with you. We heard a little sound at the top there from a short documentary by your nonprofit, greencrab.org, and I want to play a little more.
If we did nothing, they would overwhelm the estuaries completely, wipe out all the shellfish, and turn what used to be a very fertile ecological region into a barren kind of place. There were mussel colonies of at least an acre in size, if not 5 acres. I mean, they were big, 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 and they're just gone now.
So the estuary he's talking about, Ipswich, they sound alarmist there. Is this really what we're facing right now with an overpopulation of green crabs? Is it as bad as all of that sounds?
Unfortunately, it is. They are an incredibly invasive species. They are voracious predators. I mean, a single green crab can eat 40 juvenile softshell clams in a day. And so, and they reproduce at a really high rate. They compete with native shellfish of all kinds, from clams, oysters, mussels. So it really is quite a problem. It's a problem commercially for clam harvesters, for our oyster farmers who are fighting them daily, trying to keep them out of their cages and, you know, bring in their harvest. And they destroy the environment as well.
I want to illustrate this a little bit. There was a scene in the documentary where someone holds 40 of these juvenile clams, right? And they're the size of, you know, a large skipping stone, let's say. And then they hold the 40 clams that have reached the maturity age to be harvested and eaten. And it really underscores, if you eat the juvenile clams, they never grow up, which not only means you don't have them for later, but I'm assuming essentially cuts off the next reproductive cycle as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a problem, at least in farming, you have a hatchery, so you're able to repopulate and bring your new, like your juvenile oysters in. But, you know, it's decimating what you can do as a farmer. If you're losing so much of your crop early on, of course, then you're not as able to bring as much to market. In wild shellfish, it is cutting into the next generation.
So Will Robinson, who of Tamworth Distilling, when did you first learn about these invasive green crabs?
In my previous career, I was an environmental educator. Worked at an environmental education center on Lake Winnipesaukee here in New Hampshire, and we did a lot of focus on invasive species. So I was My specialty wasn't necessarily the marine environment, but I was very familiar with it. I've scuba dove in my past, so I was familiar with the issue with lionfish and the keys, and I've done some fishing as well. So the Asian carp issue that they're having in the Midwest.
Also invasive species.
Yes. Yes. And so the programs that have been started in those areas, you know, encouraging people to consume them. Just kind of the natural next step. The more awareness we have, the more people we can get consuming them, maybe we can put a dent in these populations before they really are wrecking our ecosystems.
So, Alicia, for somebody who might not be familiar with invasive species, the idea that one of the best ways to handle them, and I've heard this before with other species like Will Robinson mentioned, is to eat our way through it. There's something about that that seems so shocking. Is it? I mean, is it really novel to think to eat our way through the overabundance of green crabs?
I don't think it is. I mean, we're not used to eating them, so we don't think of eating them. There hasn't been a commercial fishery, but there's nothing particularly exotic about eating crab in general. It's an incredibly popular species. It's even very similar to a paddy crab found in Southeast Asia. So there are people eating crabs like this all over the world, where they're native in Venice. They've been embraced as food for hundreds of years, and there are numerous, you know, inventive recipes using all parts of the crab. So we're a little late to getting on board with eating it, but you know, aside from it being an invasive species, it's also an incredibly abundant, delicious resource.
And my understanding is it is delicious, although hard to kind of pick out of the shell. I guess I want to ask you. Okay, so as I understand it, we've had two different, basically, varieties of green crab that have come to our shores, some as early as the 1800s. So why are we suddenly or relatively recently having a green crab problem that maybe we didn't have before?
The problem relates to ocean temperatures. You know, while they didn't have much as far as native predators, they had cold ocean temperatures that would kill off juvenile green crabs. So it wasn't so long ago that, you know, somewhere like Ipswich, those estuaries, they would really freeze solid for a good part of the winter, to the point where people could go out and ice fish on the Ipswich River. You know, there was really those hard, hard winters we're not getting anymore. And that was really our control mechanism since they've been here in the 19th century. And so, you know, even in recent years, when we've had a harder winter, the harvesters will notice, like, okay, we get a break for a year or so. The green crab population is down a bit. But at this point, betting on cold winters as a mitigation strategy isn't, you know, doesn't seem very promising.
Okay, so that's Alicia Lomea, who's on the board of directors of greencrab.org. We're also speaking with Will Robinson, who's a distiller at Tamworth Distilling, about the invasive species green crab. So, Will, coming back to you, it was intriguing that one might not only be able to eat one's way through this problem, but drink one's way through this problem. And you've got this green crab flavored whiskey. So, dude, I don't even know where to start, but maybe it's just with what made you think that was going to taste good?
Well, I have a little bit of a culinary background as well. I've done a lot of cooking professionally in my past, and I've always been intrigued by cultures that use certain ingredients that may be considered off on their own. For instance, in Southeast Asia, Vietnam and Thailand, fermented fish sauce is a very popular ingredient in a lot of their dishes. And that as an ingredient by itself is repulsive. You would not want And so crab, you know, can kind of be a similar sort of thing. I figured it could be a similar sort of thing. And I'm from the deep South originally. So I grew up cooking, doing, you know, a lot of Louisiana cooking and low country boil and those type of things. And so in researching it, I did a lot of research into the, you know, we have about a 300-year history of seafood spice blends here on the East Coast, different types of spices used, but there's kind of like a homogenous group of them that have been used continually on the East Coast for 300 years. And as I delved into that, you know, as a potential way of working with the crab, I was able to learn how a lot of these spices that are used in the blends were actually added so that they could curb some of the offensive, what we consider offensive and consider offensive in a raw crab, in a crab by itself, you know, the aroma and the taste. And so ended up working with those spices to curb it. And I think it worked out really well.
All right. Actually. So let's pause there for a second. So you sent us a small bottle sample. It says right on it, Crab Trapper green crab flavored whiskey. It came in this little green metal crab trap, basically. And it's piqued quite a bit of curiosity around here at WBUR. And Alicia, I understand you're quite curious to taste it as well.
Very.
All right. So here's what we're going to do. I got a couple shot glasses here. I'm going to pull the cork off. I took the wax off before the show, but hopefully you can hear that now. While I pour it so that Alicia and I can get ready to taste it, Will, tell us a little bit about how you make it, and I'll be over here pouring.
Okay. Well, we, unlike a lot of distilleries around, we use a very kind of a highly advanced technological process called vacuum distilling. So we have some lab-grade glass stills that are able to operate under vacuum. And what that does is it allows us to distill aromas and flavors that might be destroyed under heat in a normal still, because you can boils at a lower temperature under vacuum, Boyle's law, et cetera. So I make a crab stock from the crabs and then remove the solids. Well, I clean them and make a stock just as if I was going to cook them and serve them.
Like a soup stock almost.
Right, exactly. And then I reserve the liquid, remove the solids, and I fortify that with some of our neutral grain spirit, which is kind of like a vodka. It's like our base spirit that we make to make gins and vodkas and those type of things with. And then we distill it in the rotovap, is what the vacuum still is called. And the distillate then is blended in with a 4-year-old reserve whiskey, bourbon reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Corn-based whiskey. Our whiskeys are very it is very corny. So there's a lot of corn there. There's a lot of nice barrel character as well.
Kind of an amber color.
Yeah, and there's some caramel and some vanilla and a little bit of maple that goes along with that. Off the top, if you were to smell the crab distillate by itself, you might get a whiff of what are called amines or amines, which are nitrogen-based compounds similar to ammonia. If you've ever noticed seafood, especially seafood that is bad, can burn your nose a little bit.
Yes.
So we use coriander as a spice for the top notes, and the coriander blends with those amines, and you don't even notice they're there. So a lot of people may, when they approach it at first, if they're not deeply familiar with seafood smells and the spices, they may not smell the crab off the bat.
No. All right. So we're going to take it back from you here. Stand by, sure. Because we have them in our shot glasses now. Alicia, smell it. And what do you think when you smell it?
I smell the vanilla and the spice more.
Yeah, the spice, the coriander, and whiskey. What I don't smell, Will, is crab. So stand by, Will. We're going to do this one at a time. You want to go first or second, Alicia?
I'll go first.
You're first. You're up. Go ahead. Take a taste. And what do you think?
It's delicious.
Yeah.
The spice is definitely there, and I think you get a little... I can taste the shellfish on the back.
Okay, so my turn here. I'm going to take a sip. Okay, so first, let me just say it hits like whiskey, right?
It does.
That's my first, and it tastes like, and you're right. Okay, so when you first taste it, first you get whiskey, then you get spices, and then at the very end, you get a little bit of shellfish. Does that make you happy, Will, when you hear that that's the tasting experience here?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And instead of walking away, I don't know if you've noticed, but like there are some of the other spices in there are clove, cinnamon, allspice.
Yes.
And those are heavy oils that coat your tongue so that you finish with that instead of walking away with a marsh mouth, so to speak.
Yeah, that is correct. I do not have marsh mouth, but I do still have some of that clove, especially. I'm a big fan of clove. All right. So this is what's possible. Now, quickly, Will, how many crabs to make a batch of this?
About somewhere in the order of about 1,000, which is about 80 to 90 pounds.
Okay. And Alicia, you can't really tell us what the count of green crabs is, but what's the size of the problem we got to solve here?
Oh, that I don't know exactly, but in good news for seafood that we want to consume, it's something we don't have to worry about over-consuming.
All right, actually, Amanda gave us a cut from the documentary that helps us quantify that a little bit. Here we go.
Where we fish today in the river, we were averaging 50 to 60 30-pound bags every time we haul the traps. If you do that for 3 months, it's a lot of crabs. And there are a million places like that, and there are crabs in every one of the places.
So, Will, for you, is that, that's overwhelming, or is that, great news, because if people like this, I have an unlimited supply of my key ingredient?
I honestly, I knew that the numbers, we're a craft distillery. Every of that by hand. I blended it myself. I cleaned all the crabs myself. The scale is obviously, definitely an issue, but the awareness goes a long way. And I knew that I had a feeling between the ick factor and the environmental factor and just the kind of just unusual in the first place thing, that it would be a good story. And really, the more awareness that we can bring to these problems, the more minds we have working on it, the more we can do something about it.
So, Alicia, you're on the board of directors of greencrab.org, a relatively new organization dealing with this invasive species, but you also work at a fish distributor. Briefly, in the fishing industry, what's the conversation about green crabs?
For shellfish farmers and clammers, they're very eager to get rid of them. I mean, we're bringing in the green crabs now at Wolf's Fish to sell to chefs in the Boston area, and we've even started shipping them beyond. Chefs in South Carolina and in Delaware and North Carolina have been interested and are taking crabs, and we're starting to sell them online. We are working with a local harvester, and there are other local harvesters who are even bringing them into Boston for us for free, just because they want to start making a dent in this population. And so they're very eager to do it. Some fisheries think of them as bait, but, for tautog and for striped bass, they can be used as bait. But there's a lot of things that we've used as bait traditionally, like squid, that now are on menus everywhere. So I don't see why that can't be the same path for green crabs.
So from bait to eat.
Yes.
And Will, I gotta ask you, there is something remarkable about this entire story, including the fact that I'm drinking this invasive species. When you made your first batch and you went to taste it for the first time, I just gotta know, what was your reaction, just quickly?
I actually filled a small vial with it and risked my driver's license driving around smelling it. I was not tasting it as much, but the aroma, just opening it back up and taking it in and thinking about it, because it was so there's a lot of depth to it. And I wanted to make sure. My impulse was like, this is good. But then I kept questioning myself because I didn't have a lot of input on it. Other input. So I'm constantly going back and smelling it. I still find myself, if I see an open bottle somewhere, I have to take a whiff.
All right, I'm taking a whiff right now. That is Will Robinson. He's a distiller at Tamworth Distilling and Mercantile in New Hampshire. They've just released a batch of green crab flavored whiskey. Also here in Studio 2, Alicia Lumea. She's a founding board member of the newly formed organization greencrab.org, and she handles marketing for Wolf's Fish, a wholesale fish company in Boston. Will, Alicia, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So imagine this. It is nighttime along the New England coast, and spiny, 10-legged creatures, 450 million years old, come crawling out of the ocean to mate. Human hunters are there to meet them, to drain them of their valuable blue blood, which the humans need for medicines to help keep their fragile bodies alive. Okay, not science fiction. That is today. These are horseshoe crabs, and the industry surrounding their valuable blue blood has taken on new significance amidst the ongoing race for coronavirus vaccines. As David Abel of the Boston Globe recently reported, last month, Charles River Laboratories began harvesting that blood off of Cape Cod, becoming the second company to do so in the region. The company moved its operations to the Cape after multiple lawsuits and critical coverage in the media caused it to leave similar work in South Carolina. The state has permitted Charles River to bleed up to 1,000 crabs a day, something advocates say could devastate the population of horseshoe crabs and upset the delicate ecosystem. And that's because tens of thousands of horseshoe crabs die every year off the East Coast as a result of this blood harvesting. And studies have found that even the ones that survive, they become less active. They seem to reproduce less frequently. Company officials haven't confirmed how many crabs they hope to bleed, but they've admitted that they're harvesting from as many as 150,000 crabs a year off the coast of South Carolina. Again, credit to David Abel from the Boston Globe for a lot of that information. So with all that in mind, we wanted to revisit a conversation we had on the show about horseshoe crabs and their importance to the ecosystem in medical research. Ipswich-based science writer Bill Sargent is an expert on horseshoe crabs, author of 27 books, including Crab Wars, A Tale of Horseshoe Crabs, Ecology, and Human Health. We talked with Sargent last fall as booster shots were becoming available and when only one company was harvesting crab blood off of Cape Cod before Charles River Labs. Sargent started by talking to us just about how cool, scientifically speaking, of course, horseshoe crabs really are.
horseshoe crabs look like something that Steven Spielberg would have designed for his stormtroopers. But there are two things that are of interest to horseshoe crabs for scientists. And one are their eyes. They have 9 eyes in all. And most of what we know about human vision comes from research on the optic nerve of the horseshoe crabs that run from their 2 compound eyes to their brain. And their brain lies in a circle around their mouths. So these guys actually eat through their brains. I don't know if you do that.
I do about
3 times a day. But the other thing, of course, about that's of interest about horseshoe crabs is that blue copper-based blood. And anything that's going to come in contact with the human blood system has to be checked to make sure that it's free of pyrogens. And the way we do that is we use the horseshoe crab blood. And so there's a whole industry that's been built up. Each horseshoe crab is worth about $1,500. So there's not only a very advanced biotech industry, but there's a basic fisheries that's similar to what could have happened in the 1700s, where people simply go out and catch the crabs very carefully, you know, and then they're bled in the laboratory, and theoretically they're returned back to the wild with no mortality. Often what happens under industrial conditions is the trucks won't show up and the horseshoe crabs will stay out in the sun and you'll get very high mortality.
So I want to break a bunch of that down. So first, in case listeners aren't completely clear on this, if it gets injected into your blood as a medicine, it's got to be tested for bacteria. And it turns out that basically, Bill, everyone uses horseshoe crab blood to do that test.
So all your listeners, you know, millions and millions of people's lives have been protected by horseshoe crab blood.
Okay.
And right now, they are sort of the unsung heroes of COVID. You know, we've all heard of Anthony Fauci and we've heard of Francis Collins, but it's really horseshoe crabs that have been protecting us from gram-negative bacteria.
And the idea is that this is a sustainable model, Bill, if the crabs are bled, so literally captured and some of their blood taken out and turned into this product that's used for testing and then put back into the wild. That's the next thing, right?
Right. But it always doesn't happen that way. You know, again, under industrial conditions, something will happen. There'll be a screw up. The truck won't show up. The horseshoe crabs are left out in the sun, and you'll get very high mortality, up to 50% mortality. The companies admit to 15% mortality now, which makes me think it's probably on average about 30%.
And New England is rich in horseshoe crabs.
That's right. And we use them primarily for these biomedical purposes. There's also a small bait fishery. So people will use them for catching eels and for conch to make skunjili. What happens now is that if you keep the crabs alive and use them for biomedical purposes, each crab is worth $1,500. If you chop them up and use them for bait, they're worth about 30 cents a pound. But unfortunately, what we're doing is we're using them for bait. There's one state, South Carolina, that has made it illegal to use horseshoe crabs for bait, and so you can only use them for biomedical purposes. And I think all the other states should follow their lead. When I first started talking about this, I'd go on radio programs and I'd take callers, and I thought I was going to get a lot of feedback from fishermen who didn't want to be told what they could use for bait. And they said, no, it's not a problem. There are plenty of other species they could use. Spider crabs work just as well as horseshoe crabs. So they really don't have a problem with it. We have a screwy regulation in Massachusetts, and they call it rent-a-crab. The fishermen will go out and collect the crabs, sell them to the companies to be bled for the lysate, and then they turn around and the crabs are given back to the fishermen to use for bait. So what you're doing is you're taking what should be, you know, 100% sustainable fisheries into 100% unsustainable fisheries.
All right. So
nobody's been able to explain the logic of that to me.
Okay, so there's a bunch of stuff in there. First, I just want to, what is spongili, or the conch and eel thing?
Scungili. Scungili you make from the, you have to have an Italian heritage to understand.
I do,
this.
But I still don't know what it is. But it's a food.
They take the meat of a conch and then you slice it up very finely and fry it up and make scungili. It's wonderful.
Okay. So this is fascinating for a number of reasons. And as I read the book, here's a couple of things that I kept thinking about. All right. So you have this delicate balance of a 450-year-old creature that nobody really knows about, and no offense to the horseshoe crab, or cares about because they don't know about it, that if we don't maintain it, we don't have the next COVID vaccine, basically. You've got two industries coming at that creature, right? You've got a pharmaceutical industry coming at it with, as you're saying, lax practices that run the risk of depleting the supply, although, as I understand it, that supply is okay right now. And then you've got the fishing industry coming at it. Is there an ecological dimension to this as well? You talk about that in the book. Horseshoe crabs are important for humans, but they're also in a food chain. Talk about that.
Well, they're absolutely in the center of you could actually call it a food web because it's so complex, but they are a keystone species that all kinds of other species depend on for their existence. The most well-known one are the red knots, which are shorebirds that migrate all the way from Tierra del Fuego in the tip of South America all the way up to the Arctic Circle where they nest and lay their eggs. And what they do, they've evolved this over millions and millions of years, that they time their migration so they're on the beach, the Delaware beaches, the beaches of Delaware Bay, during the full moon high tides. So they're there for about 2 weeks and they eat 40 tons of horseshoe crab eggs. And that gives them the fuel they need to make the next leg of their migration up to the Arctic Circle. So if you don't have the horseshoe crabs, and the horseshoe crabs are declining up and down the East Coast, and they're declining in the Delaware Bay area, then you're interfering with this. And they're already seeing that there's a lot fewer red knots, and there's also, there when they arrive above the Arctic Circle, they don't have enough fat, basically, to be able to start laying their eggs.
So there really is a chain reaction here. Now, interestingly, before the horseshoe crabs became central to my ability to get the Pfizer booster that I got in my left shoulder on Monday night, it was bunnies. It used to be that we used groups and groups and groups of rabbits to provide for this testing. Now we use horseshoe crabs. What's next? There's a synthetic version of this that could come along that would preserve this ecology, right?
That's right. There was a scientist in Singapore, and she came up with a way of using, essentially it was CRISPR technology, gene splicing technology, to develop an artificial form of lysate that you wouldn't have to use the live horseshoe crabs for.
Lysate being what's in the blood product. Sorry, we just hadn't used that word yet, Bill. So sorry, go ahead.
What we found is that it isn't as sensitive and it's more expensive and it's harder to use than the natural form of lysate. And I seldom agree with the Food and Drug Administration, but they made the decision not to approve the artificial form of lysate in the midst of a pandemic. They didn't want to switch horses in midstream, as it were. And I have to agree with them because we have about 30 years of solid data where we know that the natural form of lysate works particularly well, but we only have a couple years of trials with the artificial form. So I think what's happening is that the companies realize that eventually it will be approved. So what they're doing now is they're kind of cutting some corners. We've seen some evidence on Cape Cod that they're actually collecting the crabs in the shallow waters when they're mating. And essentially what you're doing then is you're taking the female horseshoe crabs out of the breeding population, so you're not getting the next generation of crabs. What we've done for a number of years is we set out a 100-meter transect a line along the shore, and you just simply walk along that line and count the number of horseshoe crabs. Formerly, you'd get hundreds and hundreds of horseshoe. You might get between 200 and 300 horseshoe crabs. I was down there about a month ago, and there were only two in a 100-meter transect, which indicates to me what they're doing is that they're collecting them in the shallow waters, and probably they're collecting them in the shallow waters of the Cape Cod National Seashore, which is actually illegal.
But you don't, I got to be clear, because we are a news program, you don't know this. This is what you think is happening.
Exactly. It's, I think it's fairly robust, but this is the way you collect data.
Yep.
And we've been collecting it for many, many years. I can't say absolutely that that's the case, but we saw this before in the year 2000 when there was a federal court case. And what was happening is that the Cape Cod National Seashore didn't realize it, but people had been collecting the horseshoe crabs in their waters for the last 20 years. So it was quite embarrassing to the seashore. And what they did is it was a federal court case. And they finally agreed with the Cape Cod National Seashore that they had jurisdiction over the crabs.
So we could be back there again.
And they could uphold the ban against the crabs.
That was Ipswich-based science writer Bill Sargent. He joined us in November 2021 to talk about horseshoe crabs and their significant impact on scientific research. So, we would like to invite you to become a closer part of the Radio Boston community. Over the last few weeks, you've heard us talk about our texting group, and I've given you many invitations to be part of it. I'm going to invite you again. We value your feedback. We like to put your input on air. You send us suggestions for stories or our regular segments like Hidden History earlier this week, for example. Consider joining our texting group. To do so, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Again, the word Boston to 617-766-0382. And if I went through that too fast for you, you can find that information on the About page for us at our website, radioboston.org. That's the About page at our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles with Maya Schwader. Arkees Neal is our technical director. Titus Valadoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.